Welcome back to another episode of The Occasionalists. I'm Matt Pagel here, with you on Tuesday, March 5th, 2024, getting into our second episode of the week as we look at, we've already covered the problems facing the NFL, so why don't we go to its little brother and we talk about the problems facing college football. That's right, talking a little NCAA football for this episode. But first, a little fact of the day. On this date, March 5th, 1770, hitting the Wayback Machine. This is a very important event in the founding of our history. This is the incident on King Street, better known as the Boston Massacre. British soldiers kill 5 men in a crowd throwing snowballs, stones, and sticks at them. African-American Crispus Attucks is the first to die. He is obviously held up as a martyr, certainly to the U.S. cause, the revolutionaries' cause, but also held up for a long time as one of the first early black martyrs. And this incident, the incident on King Street, the Boston Massacre, this is the incident that really tips the anti-British, the anti-colonial feelings of the Americans at this point. So this is kind of our, I want to say, our starting point towards the Revolutionary War and towards American independence. But certainly this is one of the big events that really pushes a lot of regular people into onto the side of the rebels, onto the side of the revolutionaries, as the anti-British sentiment in pubs and things kind of grows and grows and grows. This is like one of the big incidents that really, really sets a lot of people on a particular path. So that is March 5th, 1770, the Boston Massacre. So let's get into it, then. Let's massacre the NCAA just for a little bit here. That's kind of what this whole, probably what this whole episode is going to kind of break down into. We're just going to kind of kick the crap out of college football a little bit, because I think college has several problems, but I also think it has things that aren't really problems. But I think the obvious problem to me isn't the one that maybe you're thinking about. I think maybe for the most part, everyone's going to start screaming about the transfer portal or NIL money or whatever. To me, that's not what the problem is. That's not what the obvious problem is. The obvious problem to me is that college football is emerging as something different, but everyone from administration, from, you know, university administration, to the coaches, to the fans, to the way coverage of college football happens, the way the sport is viewed is very antiquated. It's antiquated in that the universities still think of them as student athletes, right? They are not student athletes anymore. These are, essentially, since there's no minor leagues of football, well, I guess you could call the UFL like a minor league, whatever. It's a spring league, but it doesn't matter. Since there's no minor leagues of football, the NCAA is the minor leagues for the NFL. These are not just student athletes. These are more increasingly professional, polished level athletes. The coaching staff, viewing them as sort of, you know, there was a point in time in every college sport where the coach was the, especially of the successful programs, you knew Bear Bryant, you knew Jim Tressel, you knew Urban Meyer, you knew Mac Brown, you knew all those names, right? And this, even in college, Coach K, Roy Williams, Dean Smith, you know, those names were always like at the forefront because the coaches, quote unquote, were more important than the players. And we're finding out that, you know, sure, coaching is important or whatever, but it's fine. Like, if you can be a great coach, if you don't get good players, you don't have good players, it doesn't matter. So that's sort of like, we still have this sort of antiquated view of like what the coach means in college football, right? And then, as I said, like the fans still have this antiquated view of them, again, being just sort of these, like, I think we still think of them as being the kids, but they're not, you know, and they are kids in many cases, but they're so much more business savvy. They're so much more aware of their own star power and own money-making power than they ever have been before. These are not like aw shucks, you know, bright eyed like 18-year-olds. These are kids who, with a lot of them, when they leave high school, already have, you know, guaranteed endorsement money for, you know, NIL endorsement money when they're like fucking 17 years old. If they weren't already earning it, when they were in high school, they are already ahead of that game, so much more so than previous generations. They're just not the same as it used to be. And the way the media views all of this, you know, the way we still try to kind of fit things into a particular box and narratives of like, you know, college football, like the how we romanticize college football, and, you know, they're underdog schools, and, you know, it's like a, you know, let's just say recently, like this, I'm going to skip past this Michigan team. I'm going to go back to the Georgia team that won the previous two national championships. Like that, this is sort of, you know, the media view kind of is like that. This is it's sort of like years past, decades past, where, you know, when you had a dynasty, you had like the same core of kids for like 3, 4, or 5 seasons, essentially, right? Like, you know, you start with like a core of, let's say, like 10 notable players, and then a few more come in a couple years after that. Those guys leave, but you, like, the names kind of seem to stretch for like 4 or 5 seasons over like a dynastic kind of college team. And there's still that sort of romantic view that like this Georgia team was just a bunch of kids that wanted to stick together and play football and win more for the University of Georgia. And that's partially true. Obviously there's plenty of kids that wanted to do that. But, you know, you look at Georgia, how aggressive they were in the transfer portal, how aggressive they, you know, they are with signing, I mean, literally just signing players, not to academic scholarships, signing players because the NIL money is going to be right there. It's not romantic the way that the media wants to make it be romantic. So the roundabout thing that I'm getting, that I've already mentioned here, the whole point here is that the way college football gets viewed from all angles is just antiquated. We need to think of it more like a true minor league to the NFL. Maybe we need to think about it as maybe being the best minor league at any level of any sport worldwide. The college football is the ultimate minor league. You know, you just look top to bottom on the big school rosters, be it Ohio State, Michigan, Alabama, Texas, you know, Oregon, wherever, top to bottom, Georgia, top to bottom, those rosters are filled with guys who will be professional athletes, will be professional football players within a year's time. Whereas you can literally go to minor leagues, like, you know, like the AAA, and obviously those guys are already professional baseball players, but there are plenty of guys playing in AAA and certainly in AA who will never sniff the major leagues unless there's a rash of injuries. They are just there taking up space. It's what they're there for. So I can make the argument that the college football, that the NCAA is the best minor league in any sport worldwide. Absolutely. So again, that to me is that the whole antiquated view of the sport is to me the obvious one. So what about the less obvious ones, but still important? So the first thing that I'm pinpointing here is sort of the perception that college football has gotten out of control. I think that this is a problem because it paints everything that the players and coaches, just paints the whole sport in a weird light. There's this idea that NIL is out of control. You know, that, my goodness, players are making, I can't believe these players are making $10 million. You know, I think that's what Caleb Williams said he made this past year. Playing, or maybe it was collectively, but I think it was might have been just this past year. He made $10 million in NIL money. Well, like, okay, but he's going to make that for his first season in the pros. Like, what? Like, truly, what's the difference, right? So there's that. Like, there's this idea that players have too much power, and, you know, I think maybe there's something to that. I'll talk about that here in a little bit. I think the ones that kind of make me laugh are these ones that. These sort of ideas that I think have come up more in recent years, especially when with the acceptance of NIL money and the transfer portal, there's this, fans get upset that, like, oh, it's all about the money now. Are you fucking kidding me? It's all about the money now? It's always been about the money. You think these universities put together these intricate, expensive programs for fucking fun? No, it's because they're gonna take all of your fucking money. That's why. It's because Ohio State turns a profit based solely off their football team. Michigan turns a profit based solely off their football team. This has always been about money and absolutely nothing else. I know it's, you know, you go back long enough, it's a little bit different, but this isn't like a new development. We are talking since once TV got involved with college sports, then it became about money. That's truly when it became about money. So it's the idea that like it's suddenly a money grab. No, it's always been a money grab. We're just not like, no one's shy about it now. No, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not being hidden anymore. There's also this idea that no one plays for the love of the school anymore. I'm going to tell you that there are plenty of players on every single roster that at every single school that they went there because they really wanted to go there. But there's plenty of them. There are plenty of kids that are at Ohio State right now that's where they always wanted to go. At Penn State, there are kids that always wanted to go there. But realistically speaking, there's also just as many kids that were looking for the best. Essentially, before the NIL money thing came along, there are kids that were just looking for the best offer. They did not care where that offer necessarily took them. Obviously, you know, family stuff might play into it and, you know, whatever else. But there, you know, for every single kid that, you know, wanted, that, you know, bleeds, that bleeds maize and blue, that bleeds, you know, the crimson and cream or whatever Alabama is, the red and black of Georgia. For every kid on the roster that bleeds that, there's a kid that would have just as easily on the same roster of Georgia. There's a kid that would just as easily have bled the Clemson orange and purple, if the NIL money offer or something else, playing time offer, positional offer, whatever, was better at Clemson, he would have just as easily gone to Clemson. So the idea that they're just playing for the school, they're playing for the colors and the symbol on the helmet, no, it's never been that way. It's never been that way. It's not like it's not like it was always every player was doing that for that reason. Okay, every single player is at a particular school for their own particular reason, whether that is the love of a university and wanting to play there, or it's because some coach said, hey, 1 year in, start, you know, you're going to be our starting defensive tackle first year. That's why they went there. Okay. I mean, that's just the way it is. And then there's this argument that bowl games are irrelevant. I would argue that bowl games have always been irrelevant. That certainly there's more spectacle. There was a little bit more spectacle with these games, with the bowl games in the past. But one, look at how many Pop-Tarts bowls and Cheez-Its bowls and Beef O'Brady's bowls and San Diego County Credit Union bowls. At least they're like trying to kind of jazz them up and make them a little bit fun and you know, weird or whatever. But those bowl games have always been irrelevant. I mean, who cares to watch like a 6-5 team battle a 7-5 team? No one's going to Mobile, Alabama in December to see those games. There's a reason why they don't really show the stands during those bowl games. So those ones are in general irrelevant. But even when you get to the big ones, the Rose Bowl, the, you know, Fiesta Bowl, Cotton Bowl, you know, whatever else, I know I'm leaving some out here, but even when you get to those big bowl games, Sugar Bowl, Peach Bowl, Orange Bowl, even when you get to those big bowl games, it would have been a big game, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, but there's still a probably better than 90% chance that even if you were watching, you know, I don't know, like an LSU play, you know, LSU play Nebraska or something. I'm just making this shit up, but LSU play Nebraska in the Sugar Bowl and LSU's 10-2 and Nebraska's 11-1. It's still a very good chance that neither of those teams will be named the college champ, you know, the college football champion, because there wasn't a playoff system. It was just as easily, if there were two 11-1 teams in a different bowl game, that would have been the national championship game. So the idea that bowl games are suddenly going to become irrelevant, I would argue that they've always been irrelevant, because if you had three games with three similar matchups, you know, in terms of record and rank or whatever, any one of those three games was just as likely to be the national championship game, which to me doesn't make any sense. Have a playoff, just like, you know, FCS has been doing for years and years and years. And if those teams are good, they'll get through and they'll win in the playoff. So this is a very long-winded answer about the perception of what's going on in college football right now, but I just don't think it's anywhere near as bad as what people feel like it. I think it's just that changes come so quickly, right? Like we had the BCS 1-2 guaranteed matchup for a long time before we went to the 4-team playoff. And we've only had the 4-team playoff for a few years. What, 8 seasons? I think we had the 4-team playoff. Was it 9? I don't know. 8 seasons, I think. We've had the 4-team playoff, and now we're already switching gears and going to the 12-team playoff. And they're already talking about a couple years after that potentially going to a 16-team playoff. I think 16's probably too much, but you know, whatever. Again, guess what, folks? It's all about money. So if they think they can make more money with a 16-team playoff, they'll do it. But it's, I think the change has come so fast. You know, once there was a countrywide ruling that certain players, you know, I forgot where the NIL ruling comes from exactly. I know I talked about it on a previous podcast. It's not like there was a specific. I think it came out of the O'Bannon brothers case. But basically, the point was, I don't think it was like a ruling that said, yes, you can make money. It's, you know, I think the ruling was more like, well, there's nothing really stopping you from making money, I think was the actual ruling. I know this, I'm not a lawyer. This is stupid legalese. It's too fine of a point, but basically it seemed like the floodgates opened like right away. And that's why, like, it just feels like things are out of control because things are just happening so quickly. But I'll tell you what, the NIL money, the playoffs are great. To me, that actually makes bowl games a little bit more relevant. If you can now stick a sponsorship on a playoff game for a bowl game that would otherwise be irrelevant. You know, the Cheez-It Bowl or whatever, or the Poinsettia Bowl, or the, I don't know, I'm trying to think of some of those other minor bowl games, more minor bowl games. Now those bowl games aren't just on name only, now they're a playoff game, which to me kind of boosts the relevance of these games up quite a bit. And there's nothing you can convince me otherwise, and I think you'll understand exactly what I'm saying here. This year's Michigan team is a product of NIL money. Not because they got paid the most necessarily, but this team stayed intact for essentially the past 3 years. I mean, this is kind of a little bit more rare that you really had the same kind of core. You really had the same core players on offense and defense for Michigan for 3 straight seasons, and I can almost guarantee you, if those kids were not making money while they were playing college football, a lot of those kids would not have stayed. They would have gone and you know, try to turn pro to try to make money as fast as they could have. But when you're making, you know, especially when you're a guy like a Blake Corum, who's a heck of a football player, no doubt about it, probably not a high level NFL prospect. If you can make $500,000, you know, $1 million playing college football at Michigan, then there is definitely, and you might not make that ever in the NFL. There certainly is an incentive to stick around at Michigan and play. When you're, you know, some of these offensive linemen and stuff, if they're making money at Michigan and they have a chance to go win a national title, I think you're going to go do it. And so the NIL money is going to keep some of these teams, not every single team, and some players have their own agendas or whatever, but you know, if you had some guys who are projected as like third, fourth round picks, and they're making $200,000-$300,000 a year, $400,000-$500,000 a year playing college football, that is really kind of enough to go, okay, well, my salary is going to be commensurate with a slot pick, you know, in like the fourth round anyway. So why don't I just stay in college, get better, maybe raise my draft stock, you know, a round or two, which could be the difference in like $1 million to $2 million per year. On that rookie deal. So why not stay and try to go win a national championship here at Michigan, or win a national championship at Clemson or Notre Dame or whatever. So I will maintain this, that this Michigan team was made possible because of NIL money. And if they did not have it, who knows if this Michigan team would have looked the same as it did a few seasons ago. But there's nothing you can say that will convince me otherwise. And I think really, like, one of the big things here is that just as I kind of alluded to before, that this is all just out in the light now, more so than it ever had been before. You don't think players weren't getting paid and getting preferential treatment and getting this and getting that, especially if they were star players? I mean, if you've ever seen the great 30 for 30 doc, The U and The U Part 2, by Billy Corbin, Miami was giving their players a lot of benefits. And that's every big school was giving their players a lot of benefits beyond a scholarship, room and board, and some food. It's just, all of this is just very out in the open and official now. Now it's official that players are getting paid. Whereas, you know, before, you know, they had to go pick up some fast food and there was, you know, $10,000 shoved in a McDonald's bag or something like that. I think the perception that things are out of control, it's just that, like, we are seeing more than we've ever seen before, and everything has changed so much faster. That's really where this comes from, why there's this sort of feeling that, like, everything is just sort of spinning out of control in college football. It's not. We are just finally catching up to the realities of what college football has been for a very, very long time now. All right, and lastly here, to wrap up college football, my last sort of problem that they're facing. Since we talked about NIL money and the transfer portal, you know, kind of feeling like a true wild, wild west, and it really kind of is, but I think the biggest problem here is the lack of standardization, or maybe the lack of central administration. And this has been a problem for the NCAA forever. Like, there is an NCAA commissioner. I think it's Mark Emmert, I think, is the NCAA commissioner. But his job as the NCAA commissioner is vastly different from, say, Roger Goodell or Rob Manfred or Adam Silver, right? Like, their job as commissioner, they are the single representative employee for a group of about 30 billionaires, right? Like, the commissioner in any professional sport is essentially the go-between and the arbiter between the players union, the players, and ownership, right? That's his job. Whereas in NCAA, there is no players union. There are no owners. It's more of an administrative position that doesn't have a ton of teeth and is spread very, very thin. If the commissioner's office wants to do something in baseball, for example, if Rob Manfred wants to launch an investigation into something, he can. You know, obviously it also depends on, you know, what the owners feel about something, because again, he is the employee of the, he's at the beck and call, he's the owner's employee directly. But if there's an issue, that comes across Rob Manfred's desk, he can do something about it, even before it gets to ownership, right? An issue comes to Mark Emmert's desk, and I'm assuming there's a lot of them. There's only so much investigative power that the NCAA has. They don't have subpoena power. There are various rules that have been patched together by individual conferences and universities. It is a bureaucratic nightmare, is essentially what I'm saying, is the NCAA versus the other leagues, which are, in their own ways, bureaucratic nightmares, but at least there's more of like a central governing sort of body to them. Whereas there is no one policing NIL. There is no one really policing the transfer portal. There are rules in the NCAA rule book that would fucking make your head spin. There are literally rules about like what bagel toppings can be on a recruit's breakfast bagel. Because there's this idea that it might offer some school an advantage over another school. It's ludicrous. There's a reason why the Michigan cheating scandal, and I'm not here to demonize or be critical one way or the other on this. The reason why the Michigan cheating scandal even happened is because other schools feel like it's going to be an advantage that having the in-helmet radios would be an advantage to certain schools. I'll tell you what, NCAA, you got a lot of fucking money. Pay for radios in every single helmet of every single player, you know, not every single player, but every single signal caller, the green, we call them the green dot in the NFL, right? That's the person who gets the actual plays radioed to them. So if you pay for the, I think it's like four or five helmets, maybe it's six helmets total per team to be the green dots. You know, you have like one on offense and defense, and there's like a backup for that person. And then I think there's one more backup behind that, essentially. So whoever the green dot is on every NCAA team, pay for the fucking radio system instead of writing ridiculous rules about how and when you can scout, and then leave some, you know, there's obviously gray area in those rules about what you can and can't do. But instead of just fixing the problem, they would rather throw more red tape at the problem. And then, you know, once teams find the gray area, or I will say this, in the case of Michigan, they definitely pushed past the gray area. But I'm going to tell you right now, just about every school has pushed past the gray area. But this all leads back to this, that we just don't have one. Mark Emmert can't go to any singular school and just tell them what they're going to do. In the same way that Roger Goodell is, you know, he's met with the owners, they have a discussion, this is what's going to happen going forward, right? You know, pending obviously certain processes need to go through league approval, through the, you know, through players union and stuff like that. But again, there is no players union in college football. So it just creates this landscape that is very, very difficult to navigate in a meaningful way in terms of like the administration, the bureaucracy, however you want to look at it, whatever you want to call it. And this just creates all of this room for teams to cheat or potentially cheat or cheat in a, you know, find the gray area, find the loopholes. This is what happened. This is like when, I can't remember the name of Maryland's head coach, Mike Locksley, I think. You know, he's lost players, he's lost backups who are being promised like $100,000 of NIL money at other schools. I'm going to go ahead and assume that kid didn't, if that's the case, that kid never got it. If he's a backup, if he's a third stringer at Maryland, my guess is no one's necessarily paying him to go play somewhere better. No offense to Maryland, they're a totally fine football program, but you know, it's not like you're taking a backup off of Georgia's roster or Clemson's roster. But the point being here, someone needs to kind of not set limits is not the way I'll say it. I think these players can go earn whatever they can earn, but there needs to be some kind of office that manages, that helps all these kids kind of sort through what's fact, what's fiction, as opposed to just kind of leaving it up to the conferences, leaving it up to the schools, leaving it up to the coaches. Someone needs to be sitting, you know, there needs to be a panel, you know, there needs to be one person heading a panel that their whole day to day is just dealing with NIL deals, going through the contract language with the kids and their parents, going through, you know, they're essentially, I know it sounds bizarre that I'm asking for more bureaucracy, but when you have such a scattered bureaucratic system, you need something that's going to bring it all together, standardize it. And I think once that happens, once you get standardization of all of this stuff in college football that's happening, be it, you know, figuring out the best way to manage the transfer portal, to manage scholarships, to write rules, to figure out NIL contracts and such, and so on and so forth. I think once you get that figured out, I think college football will feel so much more settled once we have a cohesive level of standardization from, you know, whether you go to Kent State or whether you go to Kansas State or whether you go to Georgia. It doesn't matter. You know, once every team essentially is playing by the same rules with the same advantages and disadvantages, I think that college football will suddenly feel significantly more settled. And that's it for this episode. Again, I should have thought of something to kind of sign off with, but thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading. And we will catch you on the flip side tomorrow.